75% of Americans believe in UFOs. 30% of Americans believe UFOs are vehicles from other worlds. And 3% of Americans believe they have been abducted by aliens. That's over 8 million people. They're out there, aren't they?
Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Hello, everyone. It's St. Patrick's Day, and it's 2014 with St. Patrick's Day. He hasn't lost any appeal because they still have major parades just about everywhere. Green beer, and lots of cheer. So don't drive while celebrating too much, and I think you'll be around for next week as well. That's our wish. St. Patrick's Day, 2014. I thought it would be neat if the little green men, so to speak, would land in Ireland today. But so far, I've been checking sightings reports on UFOs dedicated to Ireland, and the last one I found that actually even comes close was in February, and there were two of them, as a matter of fact. One was on the 3rd. It was a place called Carlow, Ireland, and it basically was this, you know, the standard lights in the sky, and as far as anything exciting, nothing happens other than it makes a few movements and then blinks out. Regular, familiar story. And then there was another one in February 20th. There was some lighting and some other things that were unusual appeared in the skies above Bangor, Northern Ireland. And in Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland, of course, is pretty famous for being rebellious, but they did report UFOs. So I think they've worked all those problems out anyway. And when we talk about their sighting, it's basically the same thing. It happened on February 20th, and not a human eye laid it, their eyes on the lights in the sky. It was actually recorded by a security camera at a motorcycle sales place in Bangor, Ireland, in their garage. Just thought I'd mention that before we get to the show, and I'm really excited about tonight's show. We have a couple of things we want to talk about tonight and feature. First is our guest, and he's got a new book out, Jim Mars. I'll tell you about it in a minute, and he'll really get into detail on it. And we're going to talk about a few other issues as well. Always love having Jim on, and he's no stranger to you folks at Inception Radio either. So Jim Mars will be here in just in a couple of minutes at the most. And then later on, we're going to give some information on Roger Lear and pay tribute to him, who evidently he passed away last Friday, according to all we can find. And so that's basically how the thing is shaping up in the world of UFOs as February, March. I always thought of that as being the end of winter, but boy, here in Texas and Oklahoma, Texas where Jim is, and Oklahoma where I am, and then, of course, Joe Champion. You know, he's in Chicago, and he's producing this show here, and is chief executive of the Inception Radio Network, and one member of the board. We'll get into the other two board members before the night's up and paid them tribute as well. But Joe says that it's snowing or has been snowing again in Chicago. Surprise? maybe not. Let's go ahead and bring Jim Mars on, and Jim's got a new book out you really need to check. It's called Did I say OU? Sorry about that, Jim. Our occult in history. And I was just telling Jim how that I've been recovering, and it doesn't sound like I've recovered, does it, Jim?
That's anyway, all right.
welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Jerry, and top of the morning to you. It's St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, now we got some a little Irish stuff going. Good.
We have a little Irish green going on in Texas right now. I'm wearing a green shirt, and I just downed a harp, so, you know. Are you ready for an Irish joke?
Yes.
Well, it seems this Irishman walked out of a bar, and, no, really, Jerry, it could happen.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say that's surprising.
Oh, I love the Irish. I think that's my ancestry. I've been told it's Scotch Irish, so.
My mother was Irish.
Yeah, so, Scotch Irish. I guess that's a miserly spendthrift.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Okay. My new book is Our Occulted History. Now, before anybody runs off thinking that I'm writing about devil worship or witches or zombies or any of the things that a lot of people associate with the occult, I need to point out that I use the term occulted in the astronomical sense, okay? When the moon eclipses the sun, that's called an occultation, okay? The moon occults the sun, and it simply means mask or hidden, okay? Because it covers the sun, so it hides it. And so, actually, this is simply our hidden history. This is history that you're never taught in school, and most people are unaware of, and yet it actually points to our true origins. And people may say, well, who cares what happened thousands or millions of years ago? Well, because if you don't have an accurate picture of where you're coming from, then you're never going to be able to figure out where you're going. Right, Jerry?
Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. This book has an interesting subtitle, too, about the global elite concealing ancient astronauts.
Right.
And well, so we'll get into all that. Maybe you'd like to expand on that right now and tell me a little bit about how ancient are these astronauts? Do they go back to the beginning?
Well, they're pretty ancient because they go back all through our history. If you go back and study the indigenous primitive peoples of the planet, all the way from the ancient Chinese to the ancient Hindus to the ancient Sumerians, to the ancient Egyptians, to the Aborigines, to the Dogon tribe in Africa, and even to some of the creation tales of the Native Americans, they all carry certain similar themes. And these themes are that beings came from the heavens and were able to fly through the air and then came and taught them things about like how to grow crops, how to make things. Being one of those who likes my beer, I was interested years ago to figure out where exactly did beer come from. And, you know, wine, that's a no-brainer. I can figure that one out. You know, you got a caveman. It's a hot day. He's thirsty and hot. And he looks down. He finds some grapes on the ground, and they've been laying there for a while. They got fermented. And so he eats those and gets a little high and decides, hey, that's great. And so begins the wine industry. Now, okay, no problem there. But beer, wait a minute, you've got to have just the right proportions of hops and malts and barley, and they got to be mixed in the right proportions, and then you have to add sugars, and then you have to let it sit and ferment for a certain length of time, and you got to go through all this procedure, this formula, before you can make beer. So now who in the world figured that out? Well, the truth is, nobody knows. When I went on the internet and I went to the library and tried to study out where beer came from, it's basically nobody knows. But I might point out that among the most ancient writings known to man, which would be the cuneiform tablets of the Sumer civilization there in Mesopotamia between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, which is now modern-day Iraq, they noted that these ancient Sumerians, which predate the Egyptians by several thousand years, they had at least four kinds of beer. Well, wait a minute. How did they learn how to do that? Well, they wrote down on those tablets, many of which still exist, that the Anunnaki told them how to make beer. Well, who were the Anunnaki? Well, according to the translations, the Anunnaki means those who came from the heavens and landed on the earth. So we've got this whole background, this whole concept of ancient astronauts, you know, which used to be scoffed at quite largely, and is still scoffed at by a large percentage of the population. But that scoffing is growing thinner and quieter because, especially after the success of the History Channel's series called Ancient Aliens, and the evidence is certainly almost overwhelming. It's certainly credible, but it's almost overwhelming. And, for example, let me point this out to you, Jerry. In the ancient Sumerian tablets, they said that millions of years ago, they talk about the formation of our solar system in mythological terms. And it seems that at one point, there was the Sun, Mercury, Venus, and then Mars. And then, outside of Mars, was a very large planet that they called Tiamat. And Tiamat was about four times the size of Earth, and was largely a watery world. But millions of years ago, another body, they call it a planet, the planet of crossing, which is Nibiru. Nibiru comes through. It's on an elliptical orbit, so it carries it on its farthest apogee. It goes way out past our solar system and then comes back in, and it makes an orbit every 3,600 years. And so, of course, there have been all kinds of stories in all kinds of publications. As recently as 2013, the Huffington Post reported that a new moon of Neptune is discovered. It goes all the way back into the 80s, where they said Planet X clues are getting warmer for Planet X. And so they know that the outer planets, that there are perturbations in their orbits, which means there's some other body out there that gravitationally is impacting on these outer planets. And there's some supposition that it's Nibiru and that it's actually coming around again, although if you count out back the 3,600 years, it's probably not actually due to be near the Earth until about 2060. But still, we're close enough to that that it may be coming in this way. In fact, there are those who argue that this is what's causing this sudden rash of sunspot activity and comets and meteors coming into the Earth, like the one that went into Russia here a few months back. And because this body is approaching the Oort cloud and it's pushing these asteroids and these bodies into the solar system. But anyway, back to the Sumerian story, they said that one of the moons of Nibiru, millions of years ago, as it was coming through our solar system, struck the planet Tiamat. And it demolished half the planet and just broke it into bits and to rubble. But this rubble stayed in the same orbit where Tiamat had been. And this is what we know as the asteroid belt. And I find this really interesting because when I was like, I don't know, grade school or junior high school, and we learned about the asteroid belt, even as a kid, my first thought was, well, that's a planet that blew up, you know, and it's still...
Yeah, I had the same thought.
yeah. Okay, so then, but then the odd part of the story is the other half of Tiamat coalesced and was knocked past the orbit of Mars and went into orbit on the sun side of Mars and became the Earth. And this is where the Earth came from. And of course, we know that about two-thirds of the Earth is just a big empty water-filled hole, which is known as the Pacific Ocean. And of course, people would laugh at this and say, oh, no, you know, life didn't begin on Mars or Tiamat. But yet, as science goes along, we're finding more and more. Space.com was reported on CBS News in August of just last year, saying that evidence is building that Earth life originated on Mars and was brought to this planet aboard a meteorite, said biochemist Stephen Benner of the Westheimer Institute for Science and Technology in Florida. So science is beginning to catch up with what we all thought were just ancient mythologies. So it may behoove us to pay attention to what these ancients were writing and saying, because up until now, the scientific community has scoffed at all of this and said that all the stories, for example, that are in these existing tablets, is just mythology. And yet, what they're finding out is more and more that their so-called mythology may be the fact that those ancient people were actually telling us what they knew to be the truth. The problem was we could not interpret it correctly. For example, up until the mid-1800s, most people did not even know about the civilization of Sumer. In fact, I know when I was in school, as I recall, I was taught that the Egyptians were the first great civilization in man's history. Well, now we know that the Sumerians predated the Egyptians by thousands of years. And in fact, some of the Bible's accounts, such as the story of Moses in the bulrushes and the story of Noah and the great flood, these are stories that were actually told by the Sumerian thousands of years before the Bible was ever written down. And it just got transposed into other languages and names changed, but the story was the same. And again, we're back to the fact that these Sumerians said that these Anunnaki, these people who came from the stars, came here and colonized. And so it's really amazing, but we're more and more catching up with that. In the mid-1800s, when they began to translate the Sumerian tablets, and they read about these Anunnaki who could fly through the air and had weapons of mass destruction that could devastate whole cities with one explosion, and the fact that they were able to do genetic manipulation and cloning, etc. This was back in the mid-1800s. We did not know about the atom. We did not know about space flight. In fact, the prevalent idea in science was that man could never have heavier-than-air flight. In fact, Jerry, I don't know if you knew this, but to me this is really amazing, but it was more than a year after the Wright brothers flew Kitty Hawk in 1906 that the New York Times finally got around to publishing a story about it, because at the time they had reporters there. And they had people coming in and telling them the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk. But their science people said, no, that's impossible. So they wouldn't publish the story. It was only a year later, after the Wright brothers were invited to France and went over to Europe and demonstrated their flying machine, and the European media began to report on it, that the New York Times, our newspaper of record, finally got around to covering this historic event.
I didn't realize that, Jim. That's a pretty interesting fact. I didn't know that.
So there's stuff going on right now that's not getting reported on.
Yeah. Now, what I was going to say, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that just shows once again that the media hasn't changed in forever, really.
That's true.
We're seeing the things today.
Well, and today you've got added problems. Back then, libel suits were not unheard of, but they were very few and far between. And most printers also published newspapers, and they'd publish whatever they wanted to. And you got everything from fictional stories to fictional news to humor and sarcasm and lampoons and everything else. But today, as you well are aware, Jerry, the news purveyors today, whether it be newspaper, radio, or television, they're so afraid of, number one, losing an advertiser, number two, hacking, making an advertiser mad, number three, getting involved in some kind of libel suit, that they're so skittish, they hardly will publish anything unless it comes from the government-approved news. And as a result, we are not usually told everything we need to be told about.
Yeah, brings me up to the missing airplane, which I'll talk to you before the show's over. But let's talk a little bit more about ancient astronauts and your book. It's called Our Occulted History.
Mm-hmm. And, well, the evidence for ancient astronauts, as I said before, is quite compelling. In fact, almost overwhelming. In my book, Our Occulted History, I move on from these early tales. In fact, most of what we think we know, we don't know. There was a Scientific American cover story in 2011 that said there were quantum gaps in the Big Bang theory. Why our best explanation of how the universe evolved must be fixed or replaced. So in other words, everything, you know, we're all taught, oh, the Big Bang, well, that's what happened. And now even the scientists themselves are going, well, maybe that's not exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. And then when we look around at a bunch of the so-called anomalies, that's, a scientific anomaly is just a WTF, right? And they don't really know, but there's so many things going on. Like in our own solar system right now, a lot of people have never heard of Iapetus, which is one of the moons of Jupiter, and it's an amazing thing. I meant Saturn. It's one of the moons of Saturn, and like our own moon, it's in a near perfect circular orbit, and it has one side is stationary, in that one side always faces Saturn. And when you see pictures of this thing, it looks like the Death Star in Star Wars. It's got a huge big crater up on one end, and it's got a ridge, which I guess is a ridge of mountains or some kind of a seal, circling it right at the equator. It's really an amazing thing. And then not only that, but when it's got a dark side and a light side, and when it gets in the right position, it makes the symbol of the yin yang, the Chinese indicated the opposites, light and dark, and it's got a convoluted shadow and that's why it's been called the yin yang moon. So we've just got all this strange stuff, not to mention stuff on our own moon. Like the shard, which is some kind of an object that sticks more than a mile off the surface of the moon. We've got NASA photographs showing strange objects moving across the face of the moon or parked sticking out over the edge of a crater. Or there are tracks that come out of craters and then roll across the surface. And one would be inclined to say, I'm sure, conventional thought would be, well, that's just a kind of a round boulder that rolled down the side of a crater and rolled out into the plain, which would be great, except in some of the photographs, the tracks come up the inside of the crater, which, you know, makes no sense if it's a natural object. So we just have, in fact, Jerry, we even have questions about our own moon, and none the least of which is, how'd it get where it is? Okay, when I was in school, we were told that the moon tore away from the Earth, and but then now since we've been to the moon, we know that the composition of moon rocks is totally different from the composition of rocks on Earth, and so we also know that there have been rocks on the moon found that predate the formation of the Earth. They're older than the Earth, so we have to come up with another idea. And so the latest idea is that the moon came from outside and was captured by the gravitational field of the Earth and pulled into orbit around the Earth. Well, if that's the case, you would expect to have kind of an elliptical orbit. I mean, it comes past the Earth, it's caught in the gravitational pull, it's pulled back, and then it's pulled back again. So you ought to have an elliptical orbit, and it ought to be pretty wobbly, since it's been determined by NASA that the center of gravity of our moon is not in the precise center of the moon. It's off by a couple of miles. And so if you've got a ball in the center of gravity, in the center of the ball is off center, and you try to roll it along the floor, it's not going to roll a straight line. It's going to wobble all over the place. And yet our moon is in a near-perfect circular orbit right around the equator of the Earth, with one side always facing the Earth. Even the famous scientist, Isaac Asimov, said the moon shouldn't be where it is. But it is, which means probably the only logical explanation is that some sort of intelligence parked it there. And yet,
so,
here's our...
So are you saying it captured it someplace and brought it here and parked it there? And,
yes.
And then did they use it as an observatory or a stepping-off place to get to Earth? Or why did they do that, I wonder?
Well, that's a good question. And... But apparently that's the only thing that explains the anomalies of how the moon can be in the orbit that it's in. But here's our circular thinking, Jerry. We all know there's no such thing as aliens. And we also know that the moon's been with us since the earliest writings of mankind. And we know that we didn't park it up there. So let's just not talk about it.
Well, you know, we're laughing about that Jim Mars, but that's pretty common in science and several things, even the media. They don't have an answer. They just let it go, and let's not keep it in the headlines too long, okay, and pass
right.
on.
Let's don't think about that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just weird, but I love to think about things like that. Why?
I do, too.
Why are these things like this? What's going on here?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I always look forward to having you on the air, is that the look at angles that most people don't think about.
Aren't even aware those angles are there.
Yeah, right, right. And so it's always an educational experience having you on. We're talking with Jim Mars, and he has a new book out called Our Occulted History, and we're talking about the occulted history is not talking about the occult as in paranormal, but something else entirely. And we'll continue with Jim and find out a little bit more about that. Jim, this is off the subject, but we'll get back to yours in a minute and the fascinating things we've been talking about, but that's one thing I never really thought would catch on, and it's really gangbusters, and that's listening to radio shows on cell phones.
Mm.
It's amazing. It's really coming around. It's I don't do it too much, but I just know the numbers of the people who do listen to us on a cell phone.
Well, the media
is changing constantly.
That is true, and it's kind of amazing to me, although it shouldn't be surprising. I mean, ever since they've come out with these portable tape recorders and then portable CD players, and now these players with just, you know, massive amounts of information that can be put on a chip, I know so many people who, like when they're commuting, and let's face it, due to overcrowding and traffic jams and everything else, commuting has become a real chore. You know, it's not just 10 minutes to work. Sometimes it's an hour or more, and a lot of times just inching along in traffic. And so there's a lot of folks, obviously, who are listening to all kinds of things. They used to just listen to the radio, but I know there's a lot of them now that don't want to hear commercials, and they enjoy talk radio. And they're listening to the talk shows. And now, because we have all these devices, computers and iPhones and everything else, they can tape or record, you know, a late night program. They could record your program right now. For instance, if they had something to do on a Monday night and then listen to you during the week on their way to work or while they're traveling. It really is. It's opened up a whole new vista for people for information sharing.
Yeah, and as you know, we started early on with the on-demand programming because it just made sense to me. The technology was there that, instead of having to listen live at a certain time, they could download it. And when I came up with our plans, we started putting shows out on demand a long, long time ago, and that's before really the technology had made it as
right.
convenient as
yeah,
it
yeah, you were
now.
Kind of a pioneer in that, weren't you?
Yeah, and we, it's just it's a natural progression of things.
Yeah.
And so speaking of natural progression, Jim, they captured the moon, parked it 272,000 miles or whatever away from Earth. Why? I mean, we don't know, but you got any theories or ideas or hypotheses?
Well, once you start coupling up some of the things we do know, such as the story of ancient astronauts, and you'd think, well, how did they get here? You know, and the idea of a little rocket ship, you know, that's why people, scientists, have poo-pooed the idea of people coming from another solar system or another galaxy because of the distances involved. And, of course, a little ship could not carry enough fuel to do something like that. But, of course, that's based on the idea that they would be using our primitive rocket systems. And there's a lot of people in the know today who realize and are arguing that jet engines are a thing of the past. This is what we still see in the movies, and we still see blasting off Cape Canaveral with space shuttles and things like that. But there's a growing number of people who are claiming that we already have a secret space fleet that's operating with anti-gravity devices. And so that has certainly been under study for a long time. And I think it's entirely possible that if we have something like that, then, you know, some advanced civilization that's older than ours may have come up with that a long time ago. And if they did, and if they're going to have an interstellar flight that was going to take a long time to go, then you'd need a huge vessel. And the idea seems to be, in fact, Carl Sagan, early in his career, along with some Russian scientists, were claiming that Phobos, one of the moons of Mars, appeared to be hollow. And as Carl Sagan noted, a natural object cannot be hollow. And so the idea is that they take a huge asteroid or a moonlet, and then they burrow inside of it, and then using, I don't know, heating devices or particle beam laser type weapons, they hollow it out. And then this could explain all of the maria on the moon, which are, they call the moon seas, and the material on the surface of the moon, interestingly enough, is denser than the material inside the moon. In fact, before going to the moon, the scientific community told us that these maria and some of these craters may have been the result of volcanic activity on the moon, and yet when they got there, they found out there is no volcanic activity on the moon. So it leads to the speculation that someone went inside the moon and hollowed it out using advanced technology, melted down the core of the moon, and then poured it out onto the surface, which would harden it and would then make it a artificial satellite. And then they could send that moving through the cosmos. And if you did that, you would expect that it would be picking up debris in space, kind of like bugs on the windshield. And sure enough, one side of the moon bulges as opposed to the other side and has a denser layer of dust and material, exactly as you would expect, as if it had traveled through space for a long time. So it's really amazing, but, you know, these are things that I find very fascinating, and this is what I write about in my book, Our Occulted History, but most people don't even think about it because they're never told about these things.
Yeah, you know, it makes you wonder if there's still some people inside the moon now. I mean, extraterrestrial origin.
Well, and you know, Jerry, that's not just idle speculation, because going back to the invention of the telescope, all through the centuries, people have reported seeing lights moving on the surface of the moon and things moving. In the early 50s, they said they found a bridge on the moon that was spanning a deep chasm there, and everybody looked and they saw it, and then a few months later, it wasn't there anymore. And so it's like, hey, what's going on? And I recall one time that I had occasion to interview Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth astronaut to walk on the moon. And he was being very open about things. And in fact, he said he acknowledged that some of our advanced technology of today was gained through alien technology. He has said that publicly. But I asked him, I said, well, you know, some people say the moon might be hollow. I said, what do you think about that? And he initially scoffed and said, no, the moon's not hollow. You know, okay. But then he went on to say that although we do know that it's lighter inside the moon and heavier on the outside of the moon, and he said, so we are now thinking there may be giant caverns inside the moon. Well, you know, here's the sixth guy to walk on the moon. I didn't want to argue with him, but I was sitting there thinking, well, wait a minute. A hollow moon, giant caverns within the moon. What's the difference?
Right, right. Terminology is all just a little semantics there. But
well, if you say giant caverns in the moon, then that most people they take that as that could be a natural occurrence. But if you say a hollow moon, then that has the connotation of being manufactured somehow. So I think
pretty well. Yeah, you're right on with that, of course. We're talking with Jim Mars, folks, and we got a lot of things to discuss yet. I want to pick up what we're talking about now. Just like Jim Mars, I find ancient astronauts and all of this activity going on around is just fascinating. It's so interesting that I don't even know where to pick up many times. In your book, what do you cover?
Just about everything. In fact, I go back, go all the way back to the Big Bang and then bring it all the way forward. But since the evidence for ancient astronauts is so overwhelming, and then we throw in all of these sites around the world that most people have never heard of or don't know much about, and I guess one of the most famous, of course, would be the Great Pyramid of Egypt. And, of course, we do know about that. And but others like Göbekli Tepe over in Turkey, which was recently discovered, the Osirian. I'd never heard about the Osirian. The Osirian is ancient ruins that are only visible underground. They're below ground under Seti's temple in Egypt. And so,
by when you say only visible, what exactly do you mean?
Well, I mean, we went to Abydos in Egypt, and we wanted to go visit Seti's palace. So we were there looking through this huge ancient place with all the ancient hieroglyphics and everything. And one of the guides said, do you want to see the Osirian? And I'm going, well, wow, what's the Osirian? So he takes us out back, and you go out back and down underneath Seti's palace are these giant monolithic stones placed in all columns, and there's even a cistern, and there's a waterway, and these things are huge. I mean, I don't think even modern science would probably have a hard time placing these huge stones, and they are so perfectly cut that I didn't notice any mortar being used at all. They just fit right up next to each other. And these obviously predate Egypt. And another thing I found interesting was, is they have cross pieces, and they kind of look like they were placed like Stonehenge, except Stonehenge looks like very rough and weathered stone. These are all perfectly cut granite blocks, and they are placed just one right next to each other. And there are no hieroglyphics on this. So this, to me, obviously predates the Egyptians. Plus, it's underwater a lot of the time, which is why most people, when they go, even if they know about the Osirian and they want to see it, you can't get down in there because there's water covering the place. But I just happened to hit on a very fortunate time when they were having kind of a drought, and there was still water standing down in there, but at least you could see it. However, I might point out, we had to bribe guards because there was a wooden stairway leading down into this Osirian, and that was had 2x4s crossed it, so you couldn't go down there. And so this is not normally open to the public, and it wasn't open then. But we paid a little backsheesh to the guards, and he actually pulled the 2x4 away and let us go down these stairs into this area, and we wandered around for some time, and I took some pictures. And then the next thing I know, some guards hollering at us, and he comes down, so we had to pay him too, and we continued to probe around a little bit. And then finally their gang boss or the lieutenant or somebody showed up with a machine gun and said, everybody get out of there. And I think he was just mad because nobody bribed him. But so we had to get out. But there it all was. And it's an amazing place. And that's just one of the places. Göbekli Tepe is another one like that. Machu Picchu, of course, which a lot of people know about, but very few people have actually gone there.
Where is that?
That's in South America, in Peru, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And up in the mountains. In fact, I'm always amazed at the stories of Machu Picchu because it reminds me of the biblical story of Ezekiel, who was taken up in what he could only describe as the image of God. In other words, it was something he couldn't explain. But it took him up, and it flew him somewhere, and it flew him to this ancient city that was up in some mountains. Well, I don't know of any city in the mountains over in the Middle East, so I keep thinking that it might have been Machu Picchu, because the evidence seems to be that at one point there was a worldwide civilization that covered all of the continents of the earth. And of course,
the worldwide civilization. Well, how about
right.
The Western Hemisphere?
Not just the Western Hemisphere, the entire world. Okay. And I think that this has come down to us merely as legends and vague accounts, and we have come to know it as Atlantis. And of course, the big argument about Atlantis is that there are so many different theories. One is that it was a giant island in the middle of the Atlantic, another that it's located off of Bimini in the Caribbean, and another that it was actually Antarctica before a pole shift and it was covered with ice. Others say it's the island of Santorini or other islands there in the Mediterranean, and there's even one theory that says it was in the South China Sea. And the thing is, my thought is that this is like the blind men and the elephant. They all have a piece of it, and none of them are right, but none of them are wrong. I think it was part of a worldwide civilization, and I think it was the energy source sent along via pyramids. Because we now know, there are the pyramids on the Giza Plateau in Egypt. There are pyramids in South America built by the Aztecs. There's pyramids in Central America built by the Mayan. There are pyramids in China. And now they're even finding these giant pyramids in Eastern Europe. So I think it was a worldwide civilization. And for whatever reasons, either war and or geophysical catastrophes, I think it fell into barbarism. And I think we lost a lot of that technology. And I think we're only just now today regaining the technology enough to recognize that technology for what it was.
That's a very interesting and challenging hypothesis you have there, Jim. It's you could be right. In fact, you may be. You probably are.
Well, it answers all of the anomalies.
Mm-hmm.
And it also answers why that all of these things, I'm sure you're well aware of the huge pyramids and the huge roadways and walls that they found under the ocean off of Okinawa and then off of Bimini and off of other places around the planet. And, you know, what was all that? Are these civilizations we've never heard of, or do they belong to one advanced civilization that was long destroyed before our written history began?
You know, the way you lay that out, Jim, it appears it probably was an advanced civilization that was worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And from maybe
yeah, and what was this advanced civilization? Well, again, you got to listen to these these primitives and their ancient stories and their legends. You know, the gods came from the sky. In fact, that's an interesting thing there, too, really. They all have a name for them, Quetzalcoatl or you know, or the Anunnaki or the great whatever, you know. And yet, so the language changes, but the personalities and the descriptions of these folks all remain the same. In our book, Our Cultured History, I pointed out that the gods of Sumeria, Enki and Enlil, and the gods of the Egyptians, Thoth and Anubis, Ra, and then you move to the Greeks with Zeus and Hera and, all of Aphrodite. And then those translate then when the Romans became the predominant civilization. Then it became the Roman gods, Mars, the god of war, Jupiter, the main god, you know. And yet when you stop and look, the characterizations and the personalities are exactly the same. It's just the names change because of the language change. So were these ancient people actually talking about real living beings who came here and lived on Mount Olympus or off somewhere where the normal people couldn't get to them, maybe in orbit, you know?
Yeah, they may have been on the moon.
Uh-huh.
Jim Mars is our guest. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we're on Inception Radio here. Might also check out my website, jerrypippin.com. All of these shows are there on demand as well. And a live coverage as well. So, in fact, we repeat the show tonight at 11 o'clock Eastern, 8 o'clock Pacific. So if you tuned in late, and this certainly would pique your interest, I'm sure, then go ahead and listen to the whole show beginning at 11 o'clock Eastern tonight, the replay. And then if you can't do either of that, you can listen to it at your convenience at jerrypippin.com. Also, Inception Radio has a good podcast section as well, and we have a link to it, by the way, on our website to help you out. Mike Lucas and Bob Tarmack, along with Joe Champion, are the board of directors of Inception Radio. We just wanted to take time to salute them for really being a pioneer on paranormal and UFO radio. They concentrate on that almost exclusively. Okay, now, Jim, let's get back to your book here for a minute, The Occult and History. It's an intriguing title, and as soon as you explained to me why you called it that, and the light lit up, you know, all of a sudden, this got a lot of potential.
Right. Well, what I've also done, and here's, you know, there's a lot, you can get a lot of books pertaining to the ancient astronaut thesis, including the 12 or 14 books written by Zachariah Sitchin, who passed away here in the last couple of years, and was probably the instigator of a lot of this, along with the Swiss journalist von Däniken, who actually had been promoting this ancient astronaut thing for a long time. And initially both of them were booed and scoffed at, you know, but as time goes on and there's more and more discoveries are being made, and especially now that more people are becoming aware of the topic thanks to the Ancient Aliens series on TV, we find that it's a valid subject for discussion and study. Okay, so, but what I've done here in our occulted history is my working question was, does this ancient aliens theory, can it be connected to another predominant theory of today, which you and I have talked about at some length, which is, I guess, best described as the New World Order, the idea that a handful of people are at least trying to control the economies and hence the governments of the world. And I might point out that this is pretty much also beyond dispute. It's like ancient astronauts. For example, in 2011, there's a study by the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, and they studied 43,000 multinational corporations. And they found that these 43,000 multinational corporations were controlled by a mere 1,318 companies. And all of these had interlocking ownership. Now, these 1,300 companies, in turn, were controlled by only 147 interlocking firms. And collectively, they controlled more than 60% of global revenues. And of these 47 interlocking firms, most of them were controlled by one of 20 banks, multinational banks, that also had cross directorships and ownership. And what's wild, Jerry, is that this was simply using business and corporate statistics. They pointed out, the Swiss scientists pointed out, that their study did not even attempt to analyze the family and social or other relationships of these owners and stockholders in these 20 banks. So you got 20 banks that control the world. Now, that's pretty tight central control.
Yes, isn't it?
And so there's really no question that we've got this inner circle of people who are at least trying to run the world. So my question was, can they be connected in any way to this idea of ancient astronauts? And surprisingly enough, the answer is yes. For example, we know at the top of the banking financial chain is the Rothschild banking dynasty, started back in the 1700s by Meyer Rothschild, and then he sent his six sons out, and before long they became heads of the central banks of England, France, Germany, Austria, Italy, okay? And that between them, they instigated booms and bust, wars and revolutions. In fact, the war between the states here in the United States has been largely attributed to Rothschild manipulation. They had one of their minions, a Dr. Bickley, who came over here and began to stir up the North-South pro-slave, anti-slave issue by forming a secret society known as Knights of the Golden Circle. John Wilkes Booth, the assassin of President Lincoln, was a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle. In fact, so was Sam Houston for a time. And it was the Knights of the Golden Circle that really helped agitate for the violence that followed. Now, likewise, they had another employee who was a registered Rothschild agent who came over here and soon became managing the war effort for the Republican government of the North. And at the same time, he was buying up the stock of the South. So they were pitting these two sections of the country against each other. And it, of course, resulted in the war between the states. It's really amazing. So what's the connection between the Rothschilds and these ancient astronauts? Well, in the 1920s, the Rothschilds named one of their descendants Nimrod, because they claim that they are the descendants of the ancient Sumerian god king Nimrod, who claimed to be the offspring of a human wife and a godlike father who came from the stars. Hello. And so then you continue to go on, and you find that the Roman leaders, Sulla, for example, founded a college in Rome dedicated to the Egyptian goddess Isis, who is also known as Hathor to the Egyptians, Venus, or Azeroth to the Sumerians. So again, we see that they're tracking all the way back through the Greeks to the Egyptians, back to the ancient Sumerians. In fact, the German word Kaiser and the Russian title Tsar are all just derived from the Roman, from the Latin word for king, which was Caesar. And it's all in the bloodline. For example, there's a common link in this bloodline. It's Philip of Macedonia, who married Olympias, and their son was Alexander the Great. And then we see that Geoffrey de Bouillon of France's House of Lorraine became the Crusader King of Jerusalem and founded the mysterious Priory of Sion, and also was involved with the creation of the Knights Templars. Now, both the George Herbert Walker Bush and his wife Barbara are related to Geoffrey de Bouillon. In fact, what is amazing, and this is just really raises my question mark, is that going back to the selection of 2000, there was a story from Burke's Peerage, which is a very prestigious genealogical publication in England, that was predicting that George W. Bush would become president over Al Gore. Because, in their words, quote, the presidential candidate with the most royal genes and chromosomes has, up till now, always won the White House. And they said while both Bush and Gore were related to the Windsors, the royal family of England, the Bush family was more closely connected. And, of course, as we now know, even though Gore won the election, the Supreme Court stopped the recount and appointed George W. Bush as president, so Burke's Peerage prediction became true. Well, now, that's pretty wild, but now grab this. So now you would think, well, at least now we've got Barack Hussein Obama in there, and boy, surely he has no relationship to the Bushes or the Cheneys. Ah, but au contraire. Lynn Cheney, the wife of Dick Cheney, while studying and preparing a book on Dick Cheney's family history, found that Obama is a descendant of Maureen Duval, a French Huguenot whose son married the granddaughter of a Richard Cheney, who had arrived in Maryland in the late 1650s from England. So Obama is a cousin to Dick Cheney. And then, according to the Chicago Sun-Times, that both Obama and Cheney are blood relations to the Bush family. According to the paper, George W. Bush and Obama are 10th cousins once removed, and they're linked through a 17th century Massachusetts couple, Samuel Hinckley and Sarah Sewell. Now, Hinckley is a distant relative of George Herbert Walker Bush's close friend, John Warnock Hinckley Sr., whose son, John Warnock Hinckley Jr., was the man who shot President Reagan in 1981. Now, does that go beyond the pale of acceptability or what? How could that be?
We're going to take a break here, Jim. Yeah, that was an amazing fact. I want to come back and talk to you about some other things. And you piqued my interest for sure. Always enjoy having you on. Folks, we still have lots of show to go, so don't go away. I'm Jerry Pippin. Our guest is Jim Mars.
You're listening to IRN, the Inception Radio Network, Chicago, Illinois.
Hello, Inception Radio Network listeners. This is Amanda. Remember, you can take your Inception Radio shows on the go. Just download the Inception Radio Network app for your iPhone, iPad, or Android smartphones and access live shows, past shows, guest lineups, and much more. Just visit the iTunes Store or the Google Play Marketplace and download it today for free.
Don't have a computer? Is your internet connection down? Don't worry. Use your trusty cell phone or landline and call into our listen line at 401-283-6700 to listen to the Inception Radio Network 24/7. Again, that call-in number is 401-283-6700. For the Inception Radio Network, I am MJ.
You know, when we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. Support no-kill animal shelters. It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love. A gift of life to that stray dog or cat.
This is Jerry Pippin, and we'll be back with Jim Mars, our guest, here in just a second. But first, a reminder that on June 13th and 14th in Edinburgh, Texas, there will be the Border Zone 2 conference. And it will be broadcast from gavel to gavel, all the speakers here on jerrypippin.com as well as Inception Radio. And it basically is the entire conference, and it's free. So you can tune in June 13th and June 14th. And we'll also repeat each day. So if it works like the Border Zone broadcast from last year, it'll be nonstop conference speakers all weekend. Okay, let's get to Jim Mars again and discuss some things we've been talking about, plus some more details, new ideas. You brought up the New World Order, and you basically, Jim, are pointing out an amazing fact to me, and that is that everybody seems to be related. That's you sure. Gets into the seat of power.
That's right. And what is this small clique of people that seem to be, interestingly enough, from the royalty of Europe to the royalty of England, all the way to the pseudo royalty of the United States, mainly President of the United States and First Lady, and they're all related. And then let's look and see what they're really concerned with. And throughout history, going back to the pharaohs, the Caesars, the royalty of England, to even to the Hitler's Nazis, they were all concerned with the bloodline. Who's your daddy? You know, how are you related? So in other words, see, we may think that this concern over the bloodline and who you're related to, and does it track back to the ancient gods, we may think that that's just a bunch of claptrap, and we don't want to pay attention to it, but hey, they do. They believe in it. They know this stuff. And for them, it counts. Because if you're of the bloodline, then you get to move ahead. You get to be placed into positions of power, wealth, and authority. But if you're not, then, you know, you're left outside.
Now you're in your book, Our Occulted History, you deal with the global cabal, I guess, in a way that the power is seated not necessarily just in like the United States or some other countries, but it's really more predicated on wealth, and station in life.
Right. And who has the wealth? The banks. Who controls the government? The same people that control your life. If you own a mortgage, if you have a note on a car, if you've borrowed money to buy your clothes, your food, and your restaurant meals, you know, you're really not free because you're at the mercy of whoever you borrowed the money from. And chances are it's one of the banks. And so, you know, it's like like one of the Rothschilds. The old Rothschild was quoted as saying, he says, "I care not who runs the country. I just want to know who controls the money, because whoever controls the money controls." It's the old golden rule. Whoever has the gold makes the rules. And and it's been that way.
The golden rule, literally. I mean,
literally.
Yeah.
And what's amazing is you go back and you find that with the arrival of these ancient astronauts, these ancient aliens, the Anunnaki, they began to set up kingship. They began to set up religions. They found religion was a good means of control. You tell everybody, you appoint your priest, your high priest, and he says, "I speak for God, and God told me to tell you, here's how you're supposed to live." And people bought into that for thousands of years, all the way certainly through the Middle Ages, when the universal or Catholic Church, the Roman Church, controlled everything in the Western civilization. And they had their own NSA. It was called the local priest. And you'd go to the local priest and you'd confess. And you'd tell him everything you knew, everything you suspected, and it was a tremendous intelligence surveillance system. And they used this, along with their money lending power, to gain control over the royalties, over the kings and the queens, which didn't dare do much of anything if they didn't have the permission of the Pope. And you can find this all through history. And it was only with the invention of the printing press and the Gutenberg printing press, and they began to print the Bible, which was, by the way, illegal for about 100 years. The first banned book was the Bible, because they didn't want people reading it for themselves and interpreting it for themselves. In fact, it was only in my lifetime, I was already a grown man, I think, before the Catholic Church finally allowed services to be conducted in English rather than in Latin, you know, which meant that when it was in Latin, only the people who could speak Latin, and that generally was the clergy, understood what was being said. And so then they would tell us what it all meant. But as the power of religion as a control mechanism began to wane, they turned to money changing, okay, finances. Again, golden rule. Whoever has the gold makes the rules. And are the two separate? No, they're not. You go all the way back, and we find out all the way back to the ancient temples in Sumer and in Egypt and in Greece, you know, money, the tithing, the payment of the temple to the temple virgins, the payment to the temple priesthood, it's all part of the financial system. And in fact, when you get right down to it, Jesus, the Prince of Peace, when was the one time that he actually got violent with people? It's when he broke up the money changers. And where were they? In the bank? No, they were in the temple. So religion and money have been the two major control mechanisms. Today, religion is waning somewhat, although it's still pretty strong with a lot of people. But the money, the financial situation, is now the prime means of control. And in the United States, of course, that means the Federal Reserve System, which is neither federal nor does they have any reserves. In fact, it's a collection of private banks that are in turn owned by other private banks. In fact, a plurality of ownership in the banks that own and control the Federal Reserve are not even Americans. They're owned by foreign banks and foreign nationals. And yet the Fed is in charge of our money system. And in fact, it's interesting to note that in our history, there's only been two U.S. presidents to try to thwart this money control by the international banking cadre, the first being Abraham Lincoln, who, instead of borrowing money from the international bankers, as I'm sure they assumed he would, he instead printed his own money called greenbacks to finance the war between the states. The second president, interestingly enough, was President John F. Kennedy, who in June of 1963 issued $4.2 billion in currency, not through the interest-bearing Federal Reserve System, but through the Treasury Department. And he printed United States notes, and they weren't worth intrinsically anything any more than a Federal Reserve $5 note, but we didn't have to pay interest on it. And we all know that the bulk of U.S. Budget every year goes to, quote, retire the national debt, which means pay interest on the money that we've borrowed to run the country. So these two presidents tried to put a stop to that and stop that slavery that is entailed by borrowing money at high interest rates that you'll never pay back, but is always compounded on the principal that you still owe, and you pay and pay on the interest, and you never can seem to quite get that principal down. So here's the two presidents trying to put a stop to that. And Jerry, I don't think it was just a coincidence that both Lincoln and Kennedy were shot in the head in public.
When you take all of the things laid out, they both were assassinated, and they both had crossed the Federal Reserve one way or the other, international bankers.
Exactly, yeah. In Lincoln's case, of course, there was no Federal Reserve, but it was still the coalition of international bankers that were funding both sides of the war.
Yeah.
And he was trying to
add the international bankers because, this global economy, as far as the bankers are concerned, is not new.
It goes all the way back. That's what I'm saying. In fact, you can track it all the way back to the ancient astronauts. They figured out early on because, hey, picture this, you know, we've got some of our astronauts, and they are able to go to another inhabited planet, and where the people are pretty primitive. They're still, you know, living in caves and or little small dugout villages, and they show up and say, "Here, we try some of our food. Here, you want a butter knife? Let me give you this knife. And oh, by the way, look at this little handheld TV I've got here. See these pictures on that? And bye. Listen, I've got to go." And they jump in their ship and they fly off. What are these primitives going to think? They're going to think, these are gods. These are gods. Because I believe it was Arthur C. Clarke who once said that any advanced technology would be seen as magic by people who are unaware of it.
Well, we've seen evidence of that even with Columbus landing here and the natives. They couldn't explain it any other way than, it was something supernatural, something unlike anything they've known.
That's right. And I think it's still going on today. In fact, that may even bring us up to the missing Flight 370.
Right. I wanted to get to that and find out your theories.
You have advanced technology, that's not known generally by the public, then you can come up with any cover story you want to, and nobody's in a position to adequately refute you. I see the same thing going on with 9/11, which, we're still in this period of time where we're not supposed to talk about that. But I guarantee you, Jerry, and you know as well as I do, that before too many years are out, there are already more and more people taking a serious second look at 9/11, and they are realizing that the official story does not hold up. For example, one of the things I'm talking about is, you've got 210-story buildings, steel and glass, and they were all crumpled down, collapsed down on themselves from a fire, we are told. Well, according to experts who know what they're talking about, that should have left a debris pile of more than 10 stories. And yet, it was a debris pile of less than 2 stories. And I would submit to you, where are the toilets? You know, that's one of the hardest things in the world to try to destroy if you're trying to get rid of an old toilet. What about the steel filing cabinets? Where were they? You don't find any of this. Whatever brought down the World Trade Center towers, it involved technology that the average person is simply not well aware of.
Yeah, I've been on the mend here for a while, recovering from cancer and a few other things. I keep getting new things happening to me that are not good in the medical field. They've been making a lot of progress, so I have lots of hope that I'll recover completely. And I don't know if I'm telling secrets out of school, but you were in intensive care there for a little while.
Yep. But, hey, I got over it, and I'm hoping you will, too.
Yeah, that's good. Now, the reason I mentioned that whole thing is because I am one of those that still is going to do a 9/11 show, much like you've written some excellent books on the material around 9/11. And I plan on doing a really comprehensive series that nobody's even thought of doing, but my illness has pushed it back from last year, of course, to probably the fall. But we're going to take a series of stories. That's a complicated matter, and it may be simpler than I think once you get into it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
it's simple
physics.
Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about this missing airplane. What's going on there? How could they can find almost anything. And those jet engines, they send out reports, I understand. I've talked to truckers and others who they say the company that they drive for knows whenever something goes wrong with their diesel engine, as soon as the check engine light comes on, places calls to the mechanic and to the boss or executives, and that's the way they check them too, to make sure they're on the route.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So what's happening there, do you think? You must have a theory by now.
Well, it was interesting to note that the aircraft's communication reporting system, that's the ACAR, ACARS, was switched off before this last radio message was sent. And that's according to the transport minister there in Malaysia. Well, you know, that indicates that somebody on board was actively short-circuiting or stopping the plane's reporting system. And, of course, the black box went off, and that's almost an impossibility. I have good friends who are pilots and commercial airliners today, and they say, you know, those things are built to withstand crashes, and yet there was no signal from the black box, and the only way that could be is if you somehow turn it off, and that would have to be done probably manually. So that indicates that there's something going on board. And now the latest news is that the authorities are looking very closely at the two pilots and even the flight engineer. In fact, there's one story that said one of the pilots had actually been connected to some terrorists in the Middle East. So I think we need to keep our ears and eyes and ears open to find out what's really going on.
Yeah, it looks to me like they finally admitted to change of direction and headed one of two places, and both of those places to the north. They've had long runways built since World War II, and so there's bound to be some around that they would take that plane and let it land and maybe take it off. The only thing is, how would they get more jet fuel? I'm just thinking maybe they might want to use it as a weapon later.
Mm-hmm.
And how could they control those that many passengers? But, of course, we've seen, you know.
Well, let me tie this to 9/11, because being a award-winning aviation aerospace writer that got national award for my aerospace writing, I know a little bit about what I'm talking about. And on 9/11, it really boggled my mind that four separate teams of hijackers could hijack four separate airliners from different airports and on different schedules, and yet all their transponders went off at about the same time. How is that possible? And it actually is not, because you have to understand the crew's got, you know, the hijack team has to take over the airplane, then they have to go and locate the black box, and then they have to go and shut it off. And how is it possible that they could be doing all that at the same time? From different airports and at different departure times. The answer seems to be that 9/11 involved the use of Global Hawk technology. And what's Global Hawk? Well, that's remote control of aircraft, what we now know as drones, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. The very first aircraft that went into their airspace and ahead of the bombers and the fighters were these unmanned drones. And they were being piloted by computer operators at Fort Huachuca out in Arizona. And in fact, that's one of the concerns today, is that you have folks sitting at computer terminals in Arizona and they're dropping bombs and shooting missiles and from drones onto villages in Afghanistan. And I know over the past several months there's been a reported about 150 children killed. You know, and these things hit whole villages and knock out whole buildings. And it's all done wireless. It's all done by a computer. It's all done by remote control. Okay, so that would explain on 9/11 how all of the transponders went off at the same time through Global Hawk technology. But see, in 2001, most people were not aware of Global Hawk technology. If you try to tell them that you could capture the onboard computer of a commercial airliner, override it with a signal, and then capture the computer and then fly the airplane, regardless of what the flight crew or the passengers or even the hijackers want, they would go, oh, that's not possible. But it was. And we now know it, because now you can even see ads when you go to the movies. There's ads for the Air Force and says, hey, come here, we'll train you how to fly these, you know, unmanned drones thousands of miles away. And so, yes, they had the technology. I knew about this at the time because in the late 80s, I had done an interview with an airline pilot, and at one point we were just kind of talking, and he said, you know, my job's redundant. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, the computer flies the aircraft. He said, I'm just there in case the computer breaks down. And so we got to talking further, and I found out that these computers took signals and broadcast signals. They're kind of like a GPS thing or your cell phone. They constantly send out signals, they're constantly receiving signals, and that's how they're able to determine their geophysical position and stay on their flight plan and everything. And that, therefore, it's entirely possible if you send a stronger signal, you can step on or override the normal signal, and you can capture that computer, and you can order that airplane to fly wherever you want to, land, or do whatever, crash, whatever you want it to do, and no one on board can do anything to stop it. In fact, in my book, The Terror Conspiracy Revisited, I quote the head of British Airways, who in early 2001 said, you know, hijacking is going to become a thing of the past because we now have the technology to capture the onboard computer and make the plane land safely, regardless of what the hijackers or even the flight crew want. So there you go. We know this now, but see, nobody seems to go back and apply it to 9/11, even though that technology was very much available at that time.
Yeah. In fact, this missing airplane
could have been the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They could have captured the onboard computer, and they could have flown it anywhere, and that seems to be the case because some of the cell phone signals were still there, and some of the communications were still going on. Hours after it supposedly was lost at sea. And, of course, they haven't found any debris, which indicates that it may have been captured by Global Hawk technology and then sent somewhere else to land. But it's going to be very surprising if at some point something doesn't turn up, because even if it was hijacked, they got to take it somewhere. And they wouldn't have, if they hijacked it, it's only for one of two purposes. Either they want to have some kind of demand, you know, release these terrorists, or we'll blow this up with all these people, or it's to gain a potential weapon, pack it full of explosives, and then fly it into something just like they did on 9/11. But in either of those cases, then eventually there should be some word of this plane. And the fact that there is still none is pretty fascinating and kind of scary.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, you're talking about all of this. Immediately I think of military applications and war.
Oh, of course. Well,
then, they may be able to take over airplanes. They can take over ours because they got the... I don't know if they can get into the, say, the foreign country, the invader, but they probably figured out a way to do that.
Right. Well, you know, let's face it, there's nothing technology-wise that one man can invent that another man can't figure out a way to get around it or destroy it or whatever.
That's right. Let's talk a little bit more about the book, because we were last talking about the banks and the connection. Let's go back to biblical times, for instance. There were money centers. I guess I don't know if they called them banks or not, but
no, they were temples.
Yeah,
but within the temples was money lending, money changing, money exchanging, you know, all kinds of stuff, all kinds of economic activity going on.
Yeah, and so that story, I've always wondered about Jesus when he, you know, caused havoc there with the money changers in the temple. I always thought that, you know, there was probably more than one temple in charge. Maybe that particular temple was our answer to today, the Fed. Who knows?
Could have been the central, instead of the central bank, it was the central temple.
Yeah.
That's entirely possible.
Okay,
entirely
now. Entirely
possible. And, of course, you know, there's a... I'm reminded, I saw a picture, a painting of Jesus, you know, throwing out the money changers. And the caption said, even Jesus can take only so much. And its headline, Jerry, with the word usury, okay? Now, I know that you know what usury means, but think about it. How many people under the age 50 even know what usury is?
No, I don't think they do.
Well, folks, usury simply means charging interest on a loan. And it used to be considered sinful. In fact, in the Texas Constitution, in my lifetime, back when I started in journalism in the 60s, if you charged over 3% interest, you were in violation of the state constitution, and you were charged with usury. Well, what happened was the banks began to grow more and more powerful, and they managed to buy off more and more legislators. So they kept getting them to change this, and it went from 3%, then went to 6%, then went to 8%, pretty soon 9%, then 10%, 12%. And by this time, as the interest rates continue to go up, and some of you probably are well aware that you're paying upwards to 25%, 29% interest on some of your bank cards, you know, they finally just did away with that whole provision, in the state constitution. And today, most people don't even understand what usury is. They just think that's the way things are. You go borrow money from a bank and they charge you interest. But that's not the way it's always been. In fact, it used to be considered not only against the law, but a sin to charge
interest. Yeah, it was sinful, no doubt about it. Our time's up, Jim. Give the name of the book again.
Our Occulted History.
And you like this subject all along, because we've talked about it off and on as our paths cross over the years.
Well, I've always wanted to know who's truly in charge. I mean, it's obvious Obama can't get his health care plan through, so he's not in charge. Bush, there's no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, so obviously he's misinformed, ill-informed. He's not in charge. So who's in charge? Who's really trying to run the show? And where they come from, and what gives them a right to tell us how to live? That's my questions, and that's what I try to answer in Our Occulted History.
Okay, it's available now, folks, at a bookstore near you. Right, Jim?
That's correct, or off my website, jimmarrs.com. That's JIMMARRS.com, or at any of your favorite bookstores, and, of course, Amazon.
Okay.
Thank you, Jerry.
I've always enjoyed having you on. We'll do it again sometime.
Okay. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
We're going to close the show tonight with the story about Roger Lear. Roger he passed away on Friday, and we know him basically because of implants, but he's done other things too in the UFO field, but he's been involved in a long time. And the memorial service for Roger will be Wednesday, and it's March 19th at it will be in Mission Hills, California, and the memorial service definitely will be held then, and that's on Wednesday, and it'll be held at the Eden Memorial Park. And that's in Mission Hills, California, as I said. Roger Lear has been a very interesting person all along. One thing, I don't have the details really nailed down, even though I notice on some of the social media and some other places, there's several versions of how he died. I do know that Roger had two accidents, and we'll talk about those in a minute. The latest, or the most current accident, he rolled over his car, and he was in serious shape for a long time. I think that happened in 2010. And Roger has been battling. He never really fully recovered, in my opinion, on that automobile accident. And he had another accident as well that I want to talk about. In fact, I tell you what, we did an interview with Roger Lear back in 2008 in Laughlin, Nevada. And the Flamingo at that time, I think is what it was called. And Roger sat down with the shows I was doing direct from there, broadcasting from a major UFO conference. And Roger told me about something I didn't know about him. And that was that he had had a plane crash and was able to walk away from it. So now if you stop and think about it, Dr. Lear had a plane crash. Then a few years later, he rolled his car over and was injured severely. And I think the story I hear, and I'm not sure if we can really nail this down, maybe somebody knows the facts and they can email me at jerry@jerrypippin.com and tell me. As far as I know, Roger Friday was either in the hospital or at his doctor's office, and he got up to go to the bathroom, and he never came back out. They went in and opened the door, and there he was, dead. Let's go ahead and play this interview where Roger's talking about first his aircraft crash, and then after that we're going to talk a little bit about implants and a very interesting discussion. So we'll close the show out with that.
We're at the Aquarius Resort Casino Hotel on the beautiful Colorado River, and they deal in numbers at casinos, and numbers are important in the universe. As we just went to the break, we were talking about everything has to have a positive or negative reaction, and of course, the if you're going to have order, you have to have chaos, you have to compare, if nothing else. Right, Dr. Lear?
That's absolutely correct.
You're a recognized physician, a man of medicine, a man of science. How did you get interested in this subject?
Well, I've really been interested in this subject since I was yay high to a grasshopper, because that year, that very, very famous year, 1947, I remember my father specifically bringing the San Francisco Examiner into our kitchen and laying it on a table and reading the headline of my mother, U.S. Army Air Force captures flying saucer. And he went into a long dissertation about, see, honey, I always told you, we aren't the only intelligent entities in the vastness of this universe. And I stood there and I was really impressed. Well, my father was sort of a straightforward, you know, kind of an old-fashioned guy, and if you said you were the U.S. Army Air Force, then like a plumber or electrician or a carpenter, that was your field. So in his view, you better know everything there is to know. If you're a plumber, then you better know everything about putting pipes together and which way fluids run.
Right.
And if you're an electrician, then you better know how to put the wires together so that, you know. So when the next headline came out and said not a saucer but a balloon, I mean, he was absolutely incredulous. And he said, do you mean to tell me that the United States Army Air Force can't tell the difference between a saucer and a balloon?
Yeah.
So, you know, when you hear something like that and you're a kid and, you know, you go through the kind of life that that I had. I really wanted to be an astronomer, but never had good enough grades in math, which were required for astronomy. So I went in the next best thing, which was and finally into podiatric medicine. But I've always been interested in the sky, you know, and again, as a child, I had those childhood fantasies of wanting to fly. My grandfather was a tailor, and one of the sweetest things he ever did for me was he made me a tailored Superman cape.
Wow.
And we lived on a big hill, you know, so I used to put on my cape, you know, with the other kids, and he'd go flying down this hill. Of course, you were running.
Right.
You
know.
Always wanted to fly.
I would like, always pretended I had a Superman suit on. You had a real one.
I had a real Superman.
Yeah, I mean, I had a towel and a T-shirt.
Right. Well, that's what I had before my grandfather made this. But then later when I got out of school, and when you get out of school, you don't have any money. So I used to clip out these little coupons from the newspaper where these fixed-base operators would give away a free flying lesson. So I would go down to one place and I'd say, yeah, I'd like to learn to fly. And then I would go up and I'd get a free lesson. And then I would wait for another one to come out with a free coupon. And I go to another FBO. And he says, you sure you've never been in a plane before? You never flown? No, this is my first time, honest, sir. Well, he said, you seem to be a natural for this. And I wasn't. But then I
did. But you've been through it.
So then I did this, you know, about 10 to 15 times in a year, finding these different little airports.
Well, up in the San Francisco area, there's a lot of airports.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was down in Southern California.
Okay, down there. Yeah, right.
So that's the way I did it. And then finally, I was able to get enough money to actually pay for a few lessons. And
Do you fly anymore?
I haven't flown in some years, but you know, when you fly, you always want to do something better and better and bigger plane.
It's an expensive hobby.
Yeah, more of this and more of that. Carry more weight, carry more passengers. So I got out, I checked out in the whole single engine Cessna line, and then I got checked out in the Piper line, and I said, you know, I got to get a multi engine rating. So I went down and I found a wonderful deal on a Piper. Apache 160. It was a twin, and the plane was so old, each rudder pedal was like pushing a barn door. I had to do setups to move the rudder pedals. But I got my multi-engine rating in that, and then I put some hours in an Aero Commander 500 and a number of different other aircraft.
You ever see anything while you're up there?
No, I saw a lot of sky and a lot of beautiful things.
But no UFOs.
Never saw a UFO. But I did have an aircraft accident, which I've talked about in both editions of The Aliens and the Scalpel, the two books that I had written by that title, where I did have an accident flying a Blanca 500 in 1973. And it took me 17 years to find the cause of that accident. And I blamed everybody from the mechanics to the FBO that I rented it from to the attorneys to the FAA. And I found out after 17 years that I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, because China Lake Naval Air Station was experimenting with pulse beam weaponry.
And you got one.
I got one. I was the victim of it.
But you lived through it.
Yeah, I had no idea that even China Lake was...
Lake's where a lot of the action probably was happening in there all the time.
It was, but I didn't know anything about an underground base. What, you know, I was a young guy, you know, enjoyed flying and just in the wrong place.
What was that experience like? Was there anything that you just...
Well, we started, it was a little dinner flight, which I had done many times before, carrying my wife and a couple of passengers, and we were flying from Van Nuys, California, to Bakersfield, and one of the things you do when you fly is you always go someplace to eat.
You know? Yeah, I've
noticed
that.
You eat, you fly back. So nothing extraordinary about the flight, except we were about 10,000 feet, and there was no moon, and... suddenly, we began to lose things, to make a long story short. You know, losing part of the radio and losing the transponder and losing all the navigational instruments. But we lost a series of instruments which were not interconnected. And all you could hear was this popping sound coming over the radio. And then, I mean, we could not see the lights of Bakersfield, which was very unusual. So I chose to go to an alternate airport, which was Inyokern out in the desert, which is just a little bit south of China Lake Naval Air Station. And then we began to lose everything else on the panel, started to go. So I said, we got to get this thing on the ground. So I figured, you know, mentally, if we go, I'm not going to take anybody in the town with us. We'll go to China Lake. And so we flew to China Lake, going right into the spider's den, you know, and they gave me a red light, which means don't land. So absolutely incredulous. This just doesn't happen. Finally, they came back with a green light, and I put it down about 500 feet from the threshold of the runway. It was so dark in the desert that the crash crew couldn't find us. So we finally had to signal, and they came out and brought us onto the base and ambulances and took us into a dispensary where every single piece of equipment was covered with a sheet like it hadn't been used in years. But here's a whole big active base. Mm-hmm. Why wasn't the dispensary being used? But when you're injured and you're in an accident and you got other people, you don't really think of those things. You just say, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
They sure keep things clean.
Everything's
all covered up.
That's the Navy for you.
They could barely find the light switches to turn things on. And once they got us cleaned up, they didn't waste any time getting us out of there. They took us in a military ambulance to Inyokern General Hospital. And then the next day, the base commander came out and talked to me. And asked my permission, to release the wreck to the FAA. And I thought, even at that time, being a young, inexperienced person, why would they need my, I mean, it's one federal agency to another, why would they need my permission? So I just signed the document. But they brought us all the little pieces that we had laying around in the desert, like my watch.
Mm-hmm.
They brought us my hands.
Of
the watch and pieces of a plastic comb, you know, in little bags of sand. They combed that entire area where that plane
crashed. You think they were seeing if there was any evidence of this particle beam weapon or whatever it
was? That's exactly what they were doing. Uh-huh. And then when I was so stupid and I released the plane, I don't know where it went before it went back to the FAA and the FBO. But when I got out of the hospital, I got back to the base, to the fixed base operator in Van Nuys. Guess what was missing out of the aircraft? The entire panel was gone.
The one that kept the things shutting down.
That's right. And I said, "Well, where's the panel?" Oh, well, it's out being investigated. Nobody, and this went through a long court session, which lasted for years, but we never found the panel to the plane. Nobody knew where it went.
Incredible story. Everybody survived, though, in that crash?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay, other than you. Now we understand.
I did have a near-death experience with that crash. That was my second one.
From the crash?
From the crash, yeah.
And you've had two?
I've had two.
Was the other one when you were younger? Or
the other one was I was a little bit younger, and I was...
I had a comedy partner when I was doing stand-up comedy in the 80s. He had a near-death experience. He liked to talk about it, but he didn't at the same time.
Well, I was the victim of a practical joke in that one, and but I did. I went through the whole deal, the tunnel of light, and heard the voice, and it was a very kind voice. But when that happens to you, you really can't describe it in human semantics. The peace that you feel, you really don't want to go back. You know,
yeah.
But the voice tells you it's not your time and you have to go back. But at the aircraft accident, I was there again, you know, going through
the same thing.
And it was the same voice. However,
Same voice.
However, this time the voice was very irritated. And it's like, don't you get it, you bloody idiot? You were told before, it's not your time. Very scolding in character.
Amazing.
Go back.
Irritated.
Yeah, very, very irritated. Like, don't you get it? You know, hey, stupid, you're not supposed to be here. Go back. And then, you know, I was slammed back in my body again, and the first thing that happened was I thought I was blind. And fortunately, I wasn't, because the blood had come out of my forehead and it was running down my eyes. So I wiped my eyes and I realized
and
that
you
I could
see. Right.
But... So anyway, what I said as a joke about being dead was only partially a joke.
It's maybe a joke, but you were pretty close to it.
Yeah, at least
twice.
Probably for a moment. There was a recent case.
I don't want to say third time's a charm to you.
They talked about it on Bill O'Reilly. There was a case where a guy was dead for 90 minutes.
Wow.
90 minutes in a body bag. You know, in the hospital morgue, and the guy comes back and he tells the whole story about where he's been. You know, and Bill O'Reilly is about the strangest show where you could ever hear something like that.
Yeah, that's amazing. What was his? So he actually wasn't there just for a few minutes, like you were, or seconds, or whatever. I wonder what happened in 90 minutes.
Yeah, I didn't hear the whole story, but I know that he is either writing or has written a book.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try and get a copy.
What kind of experience? You're a medical doctor. You've been involved in all of this all your life, life and death as part of this business. What do you draw from all this? This near-death experience. Your story is not different from others. They all say the same thing.
That's right.
You got to go back.
Yeah.
I don't want to.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to. And, you know, maybe when you do go, if it's the same experience, it's not.
They say, okay, you can stay.
Yeah, you can stay. It's your time. Come along. And, you know, people talk about seeing relatives and having their life go before them, especially in drowning experiences. But there are experts in that field. I'm not. My cousin is one, the very famous Ken Ring, who has written a number of books on near-death experiences. And I told him the story, and he says, yours is just, you know, one of many.
Roger Lear is our guest. We're going to take a break and come back. I'm going to find out about the implants a little bit more and find out what he talked about here at Laughlin and what's on his plate. I'm sure it'll be a busy and full plate. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away. Dr. Roger Lear is our guest. I'm Jerry Pippin. We are at the UFO Congress, and, of course, that's in Laughlin, Nevada, at the Aquarius Resort. We kind of brushed over the implant story, Dr. Lear, as far as your most recent ones. You've had some. You haven't given up. In other words, you do this quite often. And how long have you been doing implant surgery?
Well, the first surgeries we did were in 1995. Now we've done 14 cases, and as the time goes on and we're able to amass more data, we're able to make comparisons between the data from the past and the current data and kind of make new conclusions and draw things together. So now we have some numbers we can go by, and we can say, you know, statistically we have so many that are little metallic rods. We have so many that emanate from 4 to 10 milligauss of electromagnetic strength before they're removed. We have so many that show a biological coating. We have so many that that you can look at with an electron microscope. And the last one, we knew for some time that this layer, this outer layer of biological tissue is apparently growing into the metal. But now this is the first time in this last case. You know, and also, Jerry, the equipment gets better because the
companies, I hadn't thought about that, but you're right.
The SEMs, the scanning electron microscopes, get more expensive, and they get better, and you're able to do more things. Now we actually have a piece of metal with biological tissue growing out of it.
It's literally coming out of the metal.
It's growing out of the metal. And when we had a couple of experts there from MIT, and when they saw that, they called me on the phone because I wasn't in the lab. I was in the office. And I said, we've got the strangest anomaly that they have ever seen here. It's just virtually impossible to make biological tissue grow out of metal, and they're blown away. Of course, when you watch the program in its final cut, you know, after 8 days of shooting, you're shooting, maybe 10, 12 hours a day, and you wind up with about 37 minutes of programming. And then the editor sits down and cuts it to whatever he wants to cut it. You wind up with an entertainment program. You don't wind up with any kind of a documentary. So, but I'm telling you things that we're not.
How does the scientific community take to this implant?
I addressed that in my presentation yesterday. It's very, very difficult to find what's called academic honesty. Because everybody's got, even in science, there's something held over their head or there's some axe to grind. So what they can tell you privately or even in front of a camera, they can't come out in the public and actually talk about it. It just doesn't happen. Now, Dr. Doug Perovich, who is the head of the material science department at the University of Toronto, which is one of the finest material science laboratories in the world. It's the laboratory that NASA sent the material to from the Columbia disaster, because Congress passed a law that NASA couldn't do their own analysis of the metal. So here's a very trusty individual who's extremely well qualified, and all through the procedure, I spent days there with this man in the lab with an infinite amount of equipment. Modern equipment that's worth millions and millions of dollars. I mean, he was fascinated by what he saw, and I showed a few clips of some of the comments. One was, Dr. Lear, couldn't you have brought me something easier?
Yeah.
Well, here's a world-renowned metallurgist who's saying to me, couldn't you brought me something easier? And then seeing things through these various pieces of analytical equipment, and you ask him, what is it? And he says, I don't know, but we're going to try and find out. And then you watch the program, and here he is at the end of the program, coming on in a scene that was never shot while I was there. It was shot 3 weeks after I had left.
They came back to do a pickup shot.
Back to do a pickup with him holding a hunting knife, and he says, this is probably a piece of a hunting knife.
How do you think that happened?
Well, I think it simply happened because they're not going to have the guy who was responsible for the bilge that they put about the Columbia disaster being caused by a piece of tile coming off, that guy in authority, they're not going to have him coming out and talk about alien implants and that there's something unusual
in this
material. So
you suspect it was at the university level in regard to
funding?
Oh,
it's whoever funds the university and who's ever responsible for getting the contractual work from the United States to do that. They work in conjunction with each other.
I wonder why the network or the producer of the company, the production company, went along with it.
Because, like I originally said, they're in the entertainment business, and it's all entertainment. They couldn't give a hoot as to what the content is. But, you say, why do I do it then? I mean, you don't get the truth.
I wasn't going to ask you that, but why do you do it?
Well, because I get the data. I get reams and reams and reams of expensive data.
And they can't censor you.
They can't censor me. All I can do is talk to a few people.
Have you ever been censored?
No.
Okay, good.
No.
I haven't either.
I've had problems with the state, but never with the federal government.
State of California.
But I have I've had indications that the federal government knows exactly who I am. One was a telephone conversation I had with Edgar Mitchell.
Oh, really?
Who I don't know from Adam.
But he called you.
I called him,
okay,
and he returned my call, and he was on a cell phone in Florida, and my secretary said he was on the phone, and I picked up the phone, and I said, hi, Dr. Mitchell, this is Dr. Lear in California. I don't suppose you know who I am, and he's a very matter-of-fact guy, cuts me off in mid-sentence and said, but Dr. Lear, we all know who you are. So, I mean, here's an astronaut telling me that he knows who I am. So I suppose if an astronaut knows who I am, the rest of them know who I am, too. So as long as you don't, it's okay to row, but don't rock the boat.
That's a good way to close the show. Another word of wisdom from Dr. Roger Lear. Is it something we can plug? What's happening here in your life?
Well, we've gotten our movie still on the drawing boards. We've done several teasers for the film. We still need some more funds to keep that going. We now have a full budget.
I think they're lining up ready to donate to you. So
well,
actually, it would be a good investment. It wouldn't be a donation.
No, it wouldn't, because I think that the film would really be a moneymaker if it was done right. Because
You told me a little bit about what you're doing. It sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's not a documentary. Documentaries don't make any money, but this is a full-fledged entertainment film. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the research is going on, ANS research. I'm continuing to do more television events, and try and raise money where we can, because that's the only way we can continue the research. People are kind enough to donate a little bit here and a little bit there. That's just one more test we can do, or another piece of equipment that we can buy.
Our final question with Dr. Lear, what do you make of those implants? Is that a tracking device or what?
No, Jerry, I don't think they're tracking devices, because I think that any intelligence that's on a higher level than us'ns doesn't need a tracking device, especially when we know that our DNA has its own electronic signature. So if we were capable of building a device that would detect your electronic signature or anybody else, you just dial
it,
we could find you anywhere you wanted to find. Mm-hmm. So, but I do think they're devices for getting information out of the individual who they've done something to. And since most of the abduction scenario involves the taking of ova and sperm, you have to realize there's something that's genetic that's going on. If you listen to Dr. David Jacobs, who's a well-known authority, he thinks they're building, a hybrid race, and perhaps they are. But I also think that it may not be one agenda, and I think one of the possibilities is that they're actually changing human DNA, because the kids born within the last 50, 60 years are not the same human being, certainly, as I am.
Really?
Yeah, they have capabilities and abilities
we're better.
That we don't have.
The new kids are better.
The new kids are better.
Physically, at least.
They're better physically, and they're better mentally, psychologically, because they have knowledge that they don't have to get out of a book or watch on television.
You're talking about it's already there.
It's already there. It's a changing of the human race. Now, maybe they are building hybrids. Maybe if the problem isn't solved by changing humanity, maybe if the problem isn't solved that way, maybe there's an alternative. Maybe there's a hybrid race that can come if we destroy ourselves.
A backup.
Yeah, maybe there's a backup. So the agenda may not be all one and the same, but I really think that...
The clock has got us, Dr. Roger Lear. I always enjoy it. Thanks very much.
Okay, Jerry,
thanks,
my pleasure.
Shanina Johnson is our on-location producer, and of course, Jane Swartley up in Boulder is doing the final production editing. And Roger, you can take it up with her if the show's not on by tomorrow, okay?
Okay, I will, Jerry.
Okay, until next time, this is Jerry Pippin. Cheers.